come to this part of our worship, we collectively turn our minds toward the Word of God in order that we might be able to learn and grow and be edified spiritually, grow ever closer to God and Christ, and at the same time to be better prepared to go to heaven. And as we do that this morning, I want to announce to you that the sermon this morning is, first of all, about fire. Fire in both a literal and figurative sense, but more than that, it's about faith. Our faith and the relationship that faith can have to fire. And we all realize that very often the faith of God's people faces fire. Now for us, that's in a figurative sense. Your faith, probably more often than we realize, daily faces the crucible, if you will, of the heat of the opposition from Satan. Through his attempts to lure us into sin and through his attempts to cause us to fall and to give up Christianity, our faith faces fire in that sense all of the time. But there is an occasion in the Bible in which the faith of God's people literally faced fire. And I invite you, to turn to that particular passage in order that we might be able to look at Daniel chapter 3. This passage in the book of Daniel records the familiar incident of Daniel's three friends. We talk about them from time to time. We know that the three of them, along with Daniel, were exiled into Babylon, the first exile from the land of Judah, around 605 and 606 B.C., so they have been in Babylon together. They have been selected together as among the best and have been trained by the Babylonians to be in the government. But this is a familiar and interesting event in Old Testament history from which we can learn some very relevant and practical lessons for our faith facing the fire in the 21st century. And our objective is to learn the qualities in order that we might not be burned by the fire that we face. I invite your attention to the third chapter and the historical setting. We will note the first three verses in which we find in the book of Daniel, chapter 3. Give us the setting of this incident. So let's begin by reading the first three verses of Daniel 3. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces, in order that they would come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. We realize that this is an incident in which we are given a brief survey of the occurrence, but we would recognize that this time in the Babylonian history, Nebuchadnezzar has been king for some time now, but really he is at the height of his power. As we begin the book of Daniel, he has the dream in the second chapter, which I believe is related to this, but Nebuchadnezzar is king of Babylon. And what he does in this passage is around 580 B.C. He set up this image of gold for a national religion. I want us to make sure we understand that, because I can't help but think that this is somehow associated with the image that he saw in the dream. We're not given its dimensions, but we're given its content. You remember the head was of pure gold, and Daniel in his interpretation said, Nebuchadnezzar, You are that head of gold. You are superior. The kingdoms that follow you will be inferior. And so maybe in his own mind, as a result of that image of Babylon, himself as king, Nebuchadnezzar, being that head of gold, decided perhaps that he would build an entire image of gold to represent himself and the Babylonian Empire. There's a lot of discussion as to what this image is. It may have been the chief god of the Babylonians. Some think it may have been an image of himself, but we do not know. But his point was, in this assembly of these government officials from every nation that had been subjugated to the Babylonian rule, which no doubt had been exiled like the Jews had been, brought to Babylon and included in the Babylonian government, in their presence, in their population, wanted every single one of them assembled together before this image so that they would bow before it and worship. And he was requiring a national religion that everyone would follow. And this image, everyone would worship. And for the dedication, of course, all the government officials were called to gather before this image. But our point that we notice is that these three Jews, the friends of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were a part of this gathering. They were present because they had been promoted at the end of chapter 2 as a result of the recommendation of Daniel and a part of his reward for interpreting the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. He asked that these three be promoted to the administration of the province of Babylon, and they were. So you might think, perhaps, that as these three find themselves in this situation, this 90-foot tower, 9-foot wide, it says, of gold. Do you think there could be that much gold? That's what the text says. What a monument of wealth represented in that tower, that image. Find themselves as a part of the people assembled in front of it, required to bow down and worship. I'd like to relate this to the history that Mike is teaching in Bible class, especially about Ezekiel. You will remember, as Mike taught, that the prophecy or prophetic ministry of Ezekiel started in 592 and continued to 570. So for those 22 years, Ezekiel was a prophet in Babylon. And what we're saying is this event occurred just about in the middle of that. So Ezekiel is in Babylon, but he's not a part of the government, so he's not present for this incident. But he's with the people on the canal or river of Chebar. But also significantly absent is Daniel. A lot of discussion as to why Daniel is not present. Perhaps there's some given explanation, reason, that would connect to the verses in the latter part of chapter 2. But these three are. So they find themselves in this setting. Now what we want to note, this is when their faith in God is challenged. So let's look at verse 4. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whosoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. So this is very clear as to what has happened, that all were commanded, required. And what I have in that image, that graphic of a figure, of a king. Of course, at this point in this narrative represents Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the most powerful man upon the face of the earth. He ruled the most powerful nation. He lived in the biggest, grandest city upon the face of the earth. Babylon, ancient Babylon, became, and parts of it became, some of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Truly magnificent, powerful, overwhelming. And he would expect no one to ever have the courage to disobey him. He represented power and authority to command anyone to do anything that he desired. And he did. He expected all to fall down and worship before this image. They were, if did not, threatened with certain death. It was not a beheading like we hear today. It was to be cast into a literal blazing fire in a furnace, which apparently was not too far away. That could be seen by all of them. And that would be their punishment. And you can imagine the fear that that would instill. Wow, I've got quite a choice here. I either bow down and worship before that image of gold, or I get thrown into that furnace, which is obviously a very fearful, certain death. And so these individuals were not only threatened, but they were pressured by the fact that, if you can just picture this event and these masses of people bowing, apparently they were the only ones standing. They refused to bow. They had the courage, but yet we must understand upon them was the pressure that they had to be able to bow by the masses of the popular people. But on this chart, what I have is an application that I want to point out, that we today are expected to bow before the images of our time. It's not a literal image, 90 feet tall, of solid gold or anything of the nature. But there are images that Satan is tempting, pushing, pressuring us to bow before. They are the images of materialism, greed, and desire for material things. They are the images of sexual lust, the images of immorality, the images of dishonesty. And on we could go with the number of things that are becoming more and more prominent, prevalent, common, and done without shame in our world today. We are expected, you are expected to bow before those images. Your faith is challenged in that way. What are we going to do? Well, the masses are bowing. We may find ourselves in a situation where we're the only ones standing, so to speak. We're not bowing before the image of materialism. We're not bowing before the image of sexual lust. We're standing with faith in God. Our faith is being challenged, but we are standing, not bowing and worshiping an idol. But everyone else may be. But see, that's how your faith will be challenged. You may have to stand alone. You may be the only one in certain situations. And other times you may have those that will stand with you. Obviously, we stand together as fellow Christians. But this is the point, that we find ourselves in that same situation in the 21st century in this way. Now, it changes as the narrative continues in this chapter, that while their faith has been challenged, now it is openly stated. The question may come, do these men have faith? In fact, if they have faith, is it genuine faith? Well, let's notice, if you will, beginning at verse 8, at how this unfolds in this chapter. Let's learn from this occasion. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans or Babylonians came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You yourself, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. So now, you see, accusation is brought against them. They're singled out. The attention of King Nebuchadnezzar is specifically on them and their rebellion against him, their refusal to worship not only the gods of Babylon, but this particular image that Nebuchadnezzar was requiring as a national image. King responds, beginning at verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these three men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, Is it true? So you have to give him a little bit of credit here in his sense of fairness, in his sense of allowing some possible misunderstanding, and even in just the next few verses, he'll give them a second chance. He says, Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods and worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, and it's interesting how all of these are repeated several times. We'll read them again. The horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music to fall down and worship the image that I have made. Very well. I'm giving you a second chance. If you will, do it. Everything will be okay. But if you will not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? This was his arrogant attitude, his superior attitude. Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego would either do what he said or they would suffer this sure death. And he was confident that there would be no power, no God, not even among his own gods of Babylon, that could save these three from that certain death. Then, beginning at verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we're not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. It's in these statements that we find the significant open declaration of their faith, their complete, unmitigated trust in God. And I want to make a point that I think is extremely important. These three men had such faith in God. They knew God would be able to deliver them from this. He could. He had the power. But did you notice what they said? In verse 18, even if he does not, even if that's what God chooses, not to rescue us from this blazing fire, we still will not fall down and worship your gods. We still will not worship that golden image. It was just an unconditional trust in the God of heaven. leaving it completely up to him as to what he would do. They did not know. That's very important. They did not know that all they had was complete trust in God. Now, I can think about several possibilities. Put yourself in that scenario. Okay, I've got faith in God. Now, what am I going to do? Well, you may think now, okay, I may try to make a deal with God. I wouldn't say, okay, God, if you will save me from this, then surely I will be faithful to you from here on out. I will not do this and that. I'll improve, overcome some of the bad habits I have and do things like that. If you will just save me from this. In other words, put God on trial. Make God and his reaction conditional to us and our reaction to him conditional to what he does. See, that's the human nature of reasoning and trying to deal with God on our terms. I want us to see that these three men, with this complete, absolute trust in God, just simply left it up to him. It didn't matter what he did. They trusted what he would do would be the right thing. And as a result of that, they make this statement. I would like for us then, with the same kind of courage, we need to declare our faith. Don't hesitate. Don't be timid. Don't step back or try to compromise or try to make a deal. God expects us to step forth and declare openly our faith in him every and any time we face any difficulty in life. It is an open declaration of our complete trust in God. But further, it is also that which makes known what we live for, and further, what we are willing to die for. And that's what this world is coming to do to today, folks. A lot of people are being put in that situation. Exactly the same situation. It's interesting to me, and I'm sure you have realized this, that the plain of Dura, where this image was built, the plain of Dura, where Nebuchadnezzar was standing and made this universal requirement for his entire empire to fall down and worship his way, is exactly where that's being done today. This is where ISIS is. This is where the terrorist group is moving to capture their Islamic State, to establish their government and succeeding in doing so, trying to make a national, international religion out of their jihad Islamic beliefs. That's exactly what's happening today. And we fear because of that, and we pray unto God that God's will be that this can be prevented from doing any further damage. We have to trust in God. But personally, when it comes back to you as an individual and me as an individual, this is where we stand. Do we have faith or not? When it's challenged, is it there? When it's stated, is it sincere? Is it genuine? And is it that which represents what you live for? And is it that which represents what you're willing to die for? That's what we learn from Daniel chapter 3. But there's more for us to observe. It was openly stated, but it is proven. Let's continue in verse 19. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath because of their response and absolute refusal. His facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes, and were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent, And the furnace had been made extremely hot. The flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace, still tied up. So when we come to this part, Nebuchadnezzar followed through. He was determined he would do what he said he would do. He was outraged, he was angry, probably beyond what you and I can imagine. And of course, what is happening here, as we see that he followed through with his punishment, the point is that the faith of these three men was proven. It wasn't just talk. It wasn't just statements of, I hope in the future that I'm able to have that kind of faith. The faith that they had at this point in time was proven. It couldn't have been proven in a more clear, powerful way than for them to do what they did in taking their stand in trust for God. It was complete, unconditional submission to God. It's ironical, I believe. And you wonder at that point, even this early stage of this capital punishment, of what Nebuchadnezzar thought when he saw his own fire destroying his own men, his own soldiers. He sent some of the most valiant warriors to tie up these three Jews and heated the furnace to become extremely hot, but it killed his own and destroyed them. And of course, as verse 23 says, these three fell into the furnace, still tied up. And then finally, we have faith not only having been proven, okay, was it the right thing to do? And I'm sure we all wonder that. And all of us do this. We make a decision with the best information that we have, and we just hope it's the right one. And sometimes that's all we can do. We get our best information, get the best advice. But I tell you what feels good is after the decision has been made, after the action has been taken and the dust has settled for us, that your decision is vindicated. It was difficult. It was the hardest thing in the world that I've ever done, but proven to be right. That feels good. And let me say, with whatever else registers from this sermon, every single time that we make a decision that is in favor of our faith in God, it is the right thing to do. It is never, never wrong to make a decision that is consistent with our love, our trust in the God of heaven. Faith in God was first vindicated, shown to be right, verse 24, 27. Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste. He responded and said to his high officials, was it not three men we cast into the midst of the fire? Well, why did he ask that question? They answered and said, certainly, O king. He answered and said, look, I see four loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods. We wish we knew the specific identity of that fourth. There's a lot of conjecture. The text does not give us a definitive answer. The language is not that specific. Some think that as a result of the translation, the son of man, the son of God, that this was a pre-incarnated form of Christ. That's conjecture. Others think that it was some kind of a an angelic being that God had sent. And that most likely is true, especially based upon what follows in these verses. But the point is, whoever that was surely must have been God's messenger to help. Verse 26. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of blazing fire. He responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God. Come here. Then Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego came out in the midst of the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regard to these men and that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. You know how atrocious it would be to smell that which has been singed by fire. Even if we singe a few hairs on the back of our hand, it sometimes becomes a little difficult and pleasant. But they're noticing about these three, there's no indication whatsoever of any contact with fire. Their clothes are not singed. Their hair is not burned. They have even no smell of fire upon them. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, verse 28, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel. That was Nebuchadnezzar's interpretation of that fourth image. And delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command, and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own. He's just simply commending them. So what we have here, a faith in God gives occasion for God to be recognized and praised again, even by King Nebuchadnezzar. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, tongue, who speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the midst of Babylon. When we look at the application of this and understand how faith is vindicated, God is praised. Our faith in God must be sincere and genuine. And we need to look at ourselves and our own faith from time to time to make sure, if ever tested to this degree, will it have the qualities needed to continue to be acceptable to God? We must be willing to openly declare our faith, even in the face of popular masses. A lot of things are being done in a popular way by a lot of people in this world today. Changes, and most recent changes this past week, and decisions by high courts causing the homosexual marriage, the gay marriage thing to permeate more and more into our society. Things are happening day after day that cause our society to become more oppressive, more in servitude to Satan than ever before. Our faith is being pushed. Our faith is being challenged. Our faith is being pressured. And that's the reason for taking a look at passages like this, because God has provided preparation for us. He has given us similar situations. And even in our modern day current events occurring in the same geographical location, and God using these events to show us faith in Him must be the same kind of faith in us. Our faith will be vindicated and will be victorious in the face of fire. Thanks be to God who giveth us the victory in Christ Jesus. I trust that our look at this particular chapter is beneficial as we learn lessons from what God has taught, giving us the historical setting of this event, the occurrence of it in great detail and even repetition as we read through this chapter. Daniel chapter 3 in its entirety this morning during the course of this sermon. The Word of God is before us. The lessons are there. And may we learn them. And may we grow in our own spiritual strength, spiritual development, and our own spiritual courage to stand up in the 21st century and do what these did 500 plus years, even before Christ was upon the face of the earth. If you're here today and subject to the invitation as we prepare to sing this invitation song, Tim has announced number 333. As we sing this song, if you're present, desire to respond to the gospel, let us know while together we stand.